Good morning.
Good morning.
Many of you probably remember the 2012 film, The Hunger Games, based on a best-selling novel by Suzanne Collins. The Hunger Games paints a bleak, post-apocalyptic future in which North America, now a nation called Panem, is divided into 12 districts and ruled by a brutal dictator named President Snow. Snow uses fear to keep the districts in line. And one way he does this is by staging the annual Hunger Games, a barbaric contest in which each district is forced to send two children, one boy and one girl, into the capital to enter a danger-filled arena with their fellow tributes and fight each other to the death. The last tribute left standing earns special benefits for his or her district. Thus, the people of Panem are forced to surrender each year to the iron grip of the capital, while simultaneously rooting for the hollow hope of just one child's survival. In a key scene in the film, President Snow asks Seneca, his head gamesmaker, why it's essential that the games have a winner. Why bother? Why not terrorize the districts by letting all the children die? When Seneca admits that he doesn't know, President Snow says this: hope. It is the only thing stronger than fear. A little hope is effective. Too much hope is dangerous. A spark is fine as long as it's contained. So contain it. A little hope is effective. Too much hope is dangerous. On this fourth Sunday in Advent, as we're gathered together with Christmas just around the corner, I'd like to suggest that too much hope is precisely what we are called to as God's people. Not a tiny spark, but a blazing, all-consuming fire. Not a contained hope that keeps us respectable and complacent, but a dangerous hope that transforms not only our hearts and minds, but the very world that we inhabit together. In the beautiful encounter between Elizabeth and Mary that the Gospel of Luke describes for us this morning, we see a kind of hope that is creative, imaginative, defiant, and risky. My soul magnifies the Lord, Mary sings, and then her prophetic, hope-drenched song does just that. It makes visible and clear a world reordered and renewed, a world so drenched in love, mercy, blessing, and justice that only the divine child she carries in her womb can birth it into being. In my research for this sermon, I was fascinated to learn that Mary's song has been banned many times in modern history because the hope it calls forth is so subversive. While the British ruled India in the 19th and early 20th centuries, the Magnificat was prohibited from being sung in churches on the subcontinent. It was likewise banned in El Salvador and Guatemala in the 1980s for fear of inciting revolutionary fervor. And when children went missing in the so-called Dirty War of Argentina in the 1970s, and the mothers of those disappeared children postered the Capitol Plaza with Mary's bold manifesto against tyranny, the military banned her song there as well. Too much hope, they decided, is dangerous. But maybe as we are gathered here this morning, dangerous hope is the last thing on our minds. After all, it's almost Christmas, and our to-do lists are a mile long. We have gifts to buy, meals to prepare, greeting cards to mail, and family visits to either anticipate or dread. Maybe for some of us, Christmas this year holds little more than the promise of loneliness or pain. A missing loved one at the dinner table. A broken relationship that fills us with grief. A weariness with trying to do good, be good, make good. Old memories that linger and burn. How, in the face of so much that's challenging, are we supposed to fend off cynicism or cultivate something truer than cheesy holiday cheer? Where does dangerous hope come from, and how might we tap into it? I'd like in the next few minutes to highlight three lessons about hope that I think Mary and Elizabeth's encounter offers us. None of them are easy, but all of them are possible, essential, and worth reaching for. First, the gospel story suggests that hope emerges in community. For those of us who sometimes wonder what the point is of hauling ourselves to church every Sunday, consider that in this gospel story, Luke essentially describes the first Christian worship service in history. It's when Mary arrives at Elizabeth's doorstep that Elizabeth's joy overflows into praise. It's when Elizabeth offers Mary sanctuary and blessing that Mary bursts into prophetic song. It's when their love and hunger for Jesus draws these two unlikely women into each other's company that radical hope is born and God is magnified. Luke doesn't elaborate on Mary's motivations for traveling so urgently to Elizabeth's house, but it's not hard to imagine why a suspiciously pregnant girl in her time and place would run away from home. Tradition tells us that Mary is only 13 or 14 years old when she agrees to become Jesus' mother. In her religious context, her decision is a scandalous one. At best, it subjects her to ostracism and gossip. At worst, it places her at risk for execution. An unwed pregnant woman in her culture could be stoned to death on her father's doorstep. Needless to say, Mary desperately needs safety, empathy, and refuge. She needs someone to nurture and celebrate the unconventional work of God in her life. Someone to privilege unconditional love over hasty judgment. Someone to bless her through her time of uncertainty and bewilderment. Could there possibly be a better job description for the church? A better prototype for Christian community? What would it be like if we at St. Mark's sought each other out with the vulnerability and openness of Mary? What would it be like if we, like Elizabeth, received with tenderness the marginalized people who dare to come to us seeking refuge and nurture? What would it be like if our communal worship echoed the full-throated call and response of these two kinswomen who find themselves caught up in the weird and world-changing work of God and decide to find solace, strength, and sustenance in each other's company? Mary stands in for every one of us who makes the heart-wrenching decision to leave home, either metaphorically or physically, for the sake of survival. She stands in for every one of us who's been told we are too young, too naive, too inexperienced, or too marginal to carry Jesus into the world. She stands in for every one of us who has a crazy God story to tell, but needs affirmation and support to tell it. Likewise, Elizabeth stands in for all of us who've been told our time is over, our wisdom is obsolete, our prime is past. She stands in for every one of us who has known shame, disgrace, and long years of defeat as we have waited on the bizarre timing of God. She stands in for every one of us who has the gift of discernment, the ability to gaze deeply at another person and see new life brimming beneath the surface. She stands for every one of us who longs to offer hospitality, speak blessing, and share without reservation the love God has placed in our hearts. What if this room is even now filled with Marys and Elizabeths? What would it be like if we found each other, held each other, listened to each other? What kinds of dangerous hope might we cultivate through such brave communion? In his reading of this gospel story, Henry Nouwen reminds us that God's most radical intervention into history was listened to and received in community. What an incredible example for us to aspire to. Secondly, the gospel story suggests that hope emerges from trust. We know from the gospel accounts that Mary is perplexed by the angel Gabriel's announcement. We also know that she says yes to his request. But so much lies hidden beneath that simple yes. So many questions, so many occasions for doubt. Again, Luke doesn't elaborate, but I can well imagine the questions I would ask if I were in Mary's place. Is Joseph going to stick around? Will my parents still love me? Will I survive childbirth? Who am I to raise a son of God anyway? Is any of this for real, or am I losing my mind? In the midst of these questions, Elizabeth reminds Mary to trust. Blessed is she who believed that there would be a fulfillment of what was spoken to her by the Lord. In Elizabeth's mind, Mary's blessing has nothing to do with wealth or comfort. Rather, it lies in her ongoing willingness to trust God, to lean hard into his promises and believe that they will sustain her no matter what, to remember that even after the angel leaves, the light fades and the vision recedes, God's faithfulness remains. My guess is Mary carries Elizabeth's reminder in her heart for the rest of her life. After all, her vocation as Jesus' mother doesn't get easier. It leads her straight from scandal to danger to trauma to loss. How blessed can she feel when she delivers her firstborn child in a smelly stable? When she becomes a refugee fleeing to Egypt to prevent her son's murder? When her miraculously conceived baby grows up and is arrested, beaten, mocked, and killed. God's call on Mary's life requires her to be profoundly countercultural, to trust an inner vision few others understand or value. In that context, it's only her ongoing trust in the character and faithfulness of God that enables her to keep saying yes to the life she's given. "Let it be with me according to your word," she tells the angel Gabriel, meaning, against all opposing messages that tell me otherwise, I choose to trust that I am who God says I am, his child, his beloved, his favored one, his own. I don't know what specific messages you might be hearing this morning, messages that threaten to pull you away from trust and towards fear. Messages like, you're not smart enough, or you've made too many mistakes, or God has given up on you. What would it be like to let these messages go and instead, like Mary, trust that God is as reliably loving, forgiving, and faithful as Scripture promises? That you are, in fact, who God says you are, the love of his life and the apple of his eye. That this absurd God really does accomplish his best work in obscurity, choosing the small, the broken, the forgotten, and the scandalous to bear his son into the world. Blessed are those who believe that there will be a fulfillment of what is spoken to them by the Lord. And thirdly, the gospel story suggests that hope emerges in, well, messed up grammar. If that sounds unlikely, pull out your bulletins for a second and look carefully at Mary's song. Do you notice anything strange? Look at the tenses. They're completely screwed up. Mary sings as if all sorts of impossible things, things that have nothing to do with her daily reality, have already happened. God has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich empty away. Is she hallucinating? How can she say that the Lord has done these radical things when she is still living an impoverished, marginalized life under a tyrannical empire? Barbara Brown Taylor offers this explanation. Prophets like Mary almost never get their verb tenses straight, because part of their gift is being able to see the world as God sees it, not divided into things that are already over and things that have not happened yet, but as an eternally unfolding mystery that surprises everyone, even God. In other words, Mary invites us to live in the already and the not yet, to place our hope not only in the miraculous event that happened in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago, or in a future utopia we have no agency over, but in a God who simultaneously holds the past, present, and future in his hands and calls us to participate in the dangerous but beautiful reversals Mary describes. Through Mary's messed up grammar, we are invited to hope in what we can barely yet imagine, a world where justice reigns, where the hungry are fed, where the arrogant are humbled, where the rich are emptied of all that is excessive, shallow, and unsatisfying, where God's people are finally filled, not with the tyranny of endless stuff, but with the blessing of good things. Those of you who watch The Hunger Games know that President Snow turns out to be 100% right about hope. As long as the people of Panem keep their longings small, their oppression continues. But when enough of them dare to hope big, to put themselves in the vulnerable position of imagining a world more just and more free than any they've experienced in their lifetimes, everything changes. Too much hope is dangerous. It pulls us into authentic, nurturing community with each other. It draws us into the world's suffering with every expectation that healing is both possible and inevitable. It compels us to live in the already and the not yet of God's perfect justice. And it fills our hearts with songs that magnify the Lord. A little hope is effective. A spark is fine as long as it's contained. This Christmas, don't contain it. Let it sing. Let it soar. Amen.